Back at the time that the city of New Orleans was founded, there were 5 million acres of wetlands skirting what is now the Louisiana coast. Since then, a lot of that has been lost. Millions has been lost. These are lands that are both a rich natural resource for the United States and also something that is very important to the culture and the people who live along the coast. They are, however, also disappearing rapidly at a rate of something like 25 square miles every year. And not only have these losses made significant changes in the livelihoods and the cultures of the people who live on the Gulf Coast, they arguably made the city of New Orleans and other areas of the coast more vulnerable to the catastrophic damage that was caused by Hurricane Katrina just this fall. This morning on Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about the struggle to save the Gulf Coast with Christopher Halliwell. He is the author of a book that first was published, I believe, in 2001, and now has been republished with a new introduction. The book is titled Holding Back the Sea, The Struggle on the Gulf Coast to Save America. It's published as a paperback by Harper Perennial. Our guest, Christopher Halliwell, is professor of English and journalism at Baruch College of the City University of New York, and he's particularly interested in environmental journalism. He has written several books, including Listening to Earth and People of the Bayou. He is the co-author and co-editor of Green Perspectives, Thinking and Writing About Nature and the Environment. He has been on staff of a number of magazines as an environmental or science editor. He's also contributed articles to the New York Times, Times, Christian Science Monitor, Audubon, Geo, Natural History, The American Scholar. Mr. Halliwell, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
I certainly appreciate it. I was looking back, and I happened to come across a review of the book of Holding Back the Sea that was published in the New Orleans paper, the Times Picayune, in the summer of 2001. And at this time, I think there was a positive review, and I think the people at the paper felt that you were raising some important issues, and that that the hope was that this would catch the attention of people outside of Louisiana, and perhaps also in Washington. I think at some point here, the reviewer says somebody ought to send a copy of this to every member of Congress. And it quotes you as saying that you're concerned that this was an important resource. It had environmental implications. It had implications for the people who lived along the coast, and attention needed to be directed toward it. And they quote you here in this piece. You said, what I'm optimistic about is there seems to be a unified realization that there is a big problem, and it's a growing problem, and something has to be done. Well, that was 2001, and clearly nothing really was done, or not enough. And now, I guess the question is, now, post-Katrina, is the problem serious enough so that it's gotten people's attention outside of Louisiana and particularly in Washington?
Well, certainly the problem is serious enough, and I think that Katrina, in a very, very perverse way, and it's not an easy thing to say, has done a favor to or promoted the realization that something was not done, that should have been done, and something has to be done to save what remains of South Louisiana. You know, you mentioned the review in the Times-Picayune, which was very favorable, and people in South Louisiana looked upon the book very favorably. It really surprised me that the book really didn't get too far beyond the borders of Louisiana, maybe into Mississippi and Texas, but the problem, Louisiana really has been not a part of this country, and I say that in a number of ways. New Orleans is often called the northernmost Caribbean city of the Caribbean, really. And it's Louisiana, South Louisiana is known for Cajun cooking, Cajun music, Mardi Gras, the quirkiness of New Orleans. It's an area of the country that really has not been taken all that seriously. No one really knew that 25% of our oil and gas comes out of that coast, and that 35 to 40% of our seafood, the entire country's seafood, comes out of the Gulf of Mexico and is nurtured in these wetlands. This is a very, very rich, rich land and a very, very productive land. And I think that Katrina has made people realize that this is an integral part of the United States, and it's a very, very, it continues to be a very endangered part of the United States, particularly with the effects of global warming and predictions for an increasing number of fierce hurricanes next hurricane season.
Well, for people who have not been there, or maybe there have been people who have been to New Orleans but haven't really gotten outside of the city and haven't gotten into these coastal marshes, what is it like?
Well, it's a vast, vast area. As you said in your introduction, when New Orleans was first settled in the latter part of the 17th century, there were 5 million acres of wetlands, and these are really flat prairies that waving grass, cypress forests, bayous, these wonderful meandering streams that cut through them, mostly in a north-south direction. But and there are 3 million left, 3 million acres left, and as you rightly pointed out, they are deteriorating, vanishing really at the rate of 25 square miles per year. So the wetlands originally had 5 million acres, now they're down to 3 million acres, and deteriorating at the rate of 25 square miles. So it's really... I guess what I'm trying to say is that you can't see the damage when you're standing in the midst of this vast, vast wetland, because it is so vast. If you take a helicopter or fly over the wetlands, however, you can see how they are deteriorating so fast and really being torn away. It almost looks like a cloth, a green cloth, that's being shredded at the edges, the Gulf of Mexico edge. And this is all because of the levying of the Mississippi River, which has literally starved the wetlands, and the dredging of canals by the oil and gas industry and the Army Corps of Engineers, which has let storm surges rampage through the wetlands and has introduced salt water into the wetlands, which has killed off many of the freshwater vegetative species.
So would you say that it was fair to say that most of this loss, this 2 million acres that have been lost over the last couple of hundred years, I guess,
yeah.
How much is that primarily the result of human activity?
Oh, without doubt, without doubt. The United States Geological Survey did a study a few years ago which really proved that the oil and gas industry were responsible for about 35% of the destruction because of the canals that they dredged without any regard to ecology through the marsh in order to lay their pipelines and to get access to the marsh to put in their drilling rigs. And the rest of it is levying of the Mississippi, which really destroyed the whole natural cycle of the Mississippi River flooding every spring and introducing nutrients and silt into the marsh, which enabled the marsh to keep healthy and build itself up. Sort of a sidelight of that is that this is very soft, soft soil, and so when it dries out, it really subsides. And the subsidence rate in South Louisiana is tremendous. It's about 1.5 feet per century. And then when you add in global sea level rise due to global warming, that creates a total, a relative sea level rise in this area of 3 feet. So, and this is a very, I didn't say before, but this is a very, very low-lying land. It's only inches above sea level at its height. So it doesn't take much of a sea level rise to flood over this land, and with more and more storms coming across it, it's kind of inevitable that there's going to be a lot more damage done.
Mm-hmm. And just to tie it back to what happened just this past summer and in the early fall, and Katrina in particular, can one say that if the 2 million acres that are gone, if they were still there, would that have made a difference in the impact of the hurricane along the coast and specifically in New Orleans?
Well, that's a subject of some debate right now, and latest is that the marshes are really very effective in acting as a sponge for the average winter storms which come out of the Gulf of Mexico, and they're not as fierce, obviously, as hurricanes, but the marshes are very effective at sort of dampening down these smaller surges and saving the marsh, saving the estuaries where the shrimp and the oysters grow. But when it comes to a huge hurricane surge, such as the one that was produced by Katrina, particularly over in Mississippi, the marshes really would not be that effective. I mean, nothing can stop a 29-foot-high barrier of water coming at you.
Let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Christopher Halliwell. He teaches English and journalism at Baruch College, which is a part of the City University of New York, and has written a lot about environment. He has a special interest in environmental journalism, and also has a rather special interest in Louisiana, and has authored a couple of books. One is People of the Bayou, and the other is the book Holding Back the Sea, The Struggle on the Gulf Coast to Save America. It has just it first came out in 2001, but now has been republished in a paperback edition with a new introduction, and it's published by Harper Perennial. It's out of there in the bookstores now if you want to read it. Questions welcome to here on the program, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. How is it that you got interested in getting to know this part of the United States?
Somewhat by accident. I've always been, I grew up on a farm in Massachusetts, actually, and I was a kid who spent a lot of time outdoors in nature, playing in sort of tiny little wetlands around the farm, playing in the stream and all that, and I became fascinated by low-lying areas. And I didn't know that South Louisiana really existed until I started working for a natural history magazine at the Museum of Natural History. And I was sent down to New Orleans for a conference and looked out the plane window before it landed down onto this wetlands from horizon to horizon, with bayous and houses on stilts and people out in their little pirogues, which is sort of a native kind of canoe. And I was just mesmerized, and I found myself going back there and spending a lot of time with families who lived out in the marsh, trapping families, shrimping families, oystering families, and doing what they did, and that was the subject of People of the Bayou. They then told me that there was a problem with the marsh, that it was beginning to sink. All the water was beginning to encroach around their little cabins in their bayou communities, and that propelled me to write Holding Back the Sea, which is more of a look at what's going on to create this problem and what is being done to address it.
Let me ask you to talk a little bit more about the consequences side of thing, and perhaps just going to that idea that you think that a lot of people in America don't really appreciate just how important this region is, and that one of the things that people learned that they hadn't known before after Katrina was how much of the oil and gas that we use comes from there, and how much of the seafood that we eat comes from there. If you ask about the sort of ask the so what question about the loss of these wetlands, if we lose 2 million acres, maybe just talking in terms of economic impact, what does that mean not only to the people of Louisiana and maybe the people who live right along the coast, but what does that mean to the United States as a whole?
Well, when you consider that the wetlands are a wonderful nursery for all of this seafood which comes out of the Gulf of Mexico. Shrimp are, the little shrimp are, juvenile shrimp are nurtured, protected in the crevices and the winding twists of the estuaries. Oysters grow in the estuaries, and the finfish species, many finfish species, from redfish to menhaden various snapper species, all grow up in these little tiny rivulets. I mean, it's quite a complicated system just physically to see all the little passages of water that course through the wetlands. A storm comes along and wipes out this nursery, true nursery, and that has a tremendous effect on the ability of the fish population to sustain itself. And 25% of all the oysters that we eat in this country come from these estuaries. Now, the shrimp is not in such dire straits because 80% of our shrimp are, for good or for bad, imported from shrimp farms in China, Thailand, South America. So the shrimping is still a very important industry, but not as important as it once was. And when you get to energy, a lot of our energy comes from the offshore wells, and it used to come from wells right in the wetlands, which have now been pumped out, and the whole industry has moved offshore. But all that oil and gas is piped to refineries along the Mississippi River and over in the state of Mississippi. All those pipes, and there are just—it's like a maze of spaghetti coming across the coast, a maze of iron spaghetti in these pipes, and they're kind of nestled into the muck, the sediment of the wetlands. And a storm comes along and will wipe away all of the sediment and expose these pipes. And that introduces a very dangerous situation because all these pipes are exposed to further winds. And after Hurricane Andrew in 1992, that was the first incident of oil pipes being just twisted and snapped by the force of the winds. There was a tremendous amount of damage last year as a result of Ivan, and this year as a result of Rita and Katrina. So this is an ongoing process, and as the wetlands are chewed away at more and more pipe is being exposed, and the leakage from these pipes will not only damage what's left of the wetlands in terms of their ability to sustain the fish life, but also it's when they do break, they have the whole flow of oil and gas has to be stopped in order for repairs to be made.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple callers here. Why don't we bring them in and start with someone? Well, they're both here local. We start with someone here in Champaign-Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. A scientist claimed that the effects were predicted. Sent an email to a lot of people, but was ignored. And comment on the bridges. Like, there was a photo of the clover leaf, part of which was underwater. But what about the actual bridges like leading away from the city or over the Mississippi?
Well, those bridges were withheld the force pretty well, but the danger is the lower lying bridges across bayous, sort of mostly to the west of the city. And there's one famous bridge called the Leesville Bridge, and that is on the south and to the west of the city, along a bayou called Bayou Lafourche. And this bridge was quite severely damaged during Rita. And it's a vital, vital bridge, just going back to the oil industry, because it leads to a place called Port Fouchon. And Port Fouchon is the oil and gas supply terminal for all of the offshore oil and gas platforms. And it's the bridge is vital to get equipment to this port, which is then either helicoptered or taken out by boat to the rigs. And the whole infrastructure of the oil and gas industry was stopped for a certain amount of time, a couple of days, because of damage, hurricane damage to this bridge. So this is a good question. Bridges around New Orleans did hold up, but it was the other bridges that didn't receive media attention that were very compromised.
It seems, just to talk a little bit about the other question, that people in New Orleans have been concerned about impact of hurricanes for a long time, and that at least for the last, I don't know, maybe decade or so, very concerned. And in fact, people there, scientists and other people in the region, pretty much predicted what happened, or at least they said, look, if we get a big hurricane in here, a Category 3 or bigger, what actually did happen could happen. So it is, again, and I suppose it's the kind of thing that was said a lot after Katrina, that you can't say, gosh, no one could imagine such a thing having happened, because, in fact, a lot of people did.
A lot of people knew this was going to happen. There was talk constantly about the big one and when would the big one strike. And one irony is that there were a lot of big ones headed right for New Orleans. In 1998, when I first started my research, Hurricane George had just passed by, and at one point, Hurricane George, it wasn't a Category 5, I think it may have been a high Category 3, was headed right for New Orleans, and it veered over to the west, I believe, at the last moment. And then there were a couple of other hurricanes that veered over to the east at the last moment. But New Orleans experienced so many near misses that there was a feeling that we're going to get the big one day, but isn't it, are we blessed, sort of, nothing has struck us yet? Of course, the memory is short, and in 1965, Hurricane Betsy came roaring into New Orleans and caused a lot of flooding, a levee breach, and a lot of flooding in the Ninth Ward. And pictures, photographs of Hurricane Betsy's damage look almost identical to Hurricane Katrina's damage.
Well, we talked a little bit earlier about, I asked the question whether if these millions of acres of wetlands that have been lost since the time that New Orleans was there were suddenly restored, if we could snap our fingers and they would be back, would that have made much difference to the kind of impact of Katrina? And I think your answer was, well, not really, not with a storm that big. So it gets you thinking about other places around the world that are low to sea level. There are some places where they have put in place mechanical barriers to protect against just such a thing.
Yeah.
What sort of are there some things at least being discussed, and paying for them, and I'm sure is another sort of issue, but something like that being discussed that would could be built, could be put in place, that would protect the city from that kind of damage if there was another hurricane like that. And also now I guess we should note that already people that track tropical storms are making predictions that the year 2006 could be as bad as 2005.
Well, another irony, back in 1962, plans were put in place to construct a gate which would form a barrier between Lake Pontchartrain and the Gulf of Mexico. There is an opening from Lake Pontchartrain directly into the Gulf of Mexico, and it's about two-thirds of a mile wide. In 1962, there were plans to put a wall with a gate that could be opened or closed, and that was fiercely protested by environmental groups who argued that it would change the salinity of Lake Pontchartrain and have a tremendously detrimental effect on the oyster population and other marine life populations, and eventually defeated the plan. And then it was revived again under when Jimmy Carter was president, and the plan was still sort of simmering along, and then Reagan became president, and he scotched the idea due to financial concerns, because this would be a multi-billion-dollar project. And that was the end of it. But I find it very, very ironic that a lot of plans are on the books to create this gate system and to raise the levees to meet Category 5 standards. And if you go back into the records, you see there were about eight times all these projects were talked about, designed, ready to go, and then the financial realization hit that the federal government was not ready to put in this kind of money.
Let's talk with someone else here. Urbana, line two. Hello.
Well, what you just, with that just review, points up the fact that the various levels of government do not really want to protect at least the cities in these in a vulnerable area such as New Orleans, which probably shouldn't have been extended as much as it has. And also the governments, local and state there in Louisiana, have always been portrayed as a vulnerable or incompetent or flat-out corrupt. Who's makes the major decisions for the area? The oil and gas companies? That's my question.
Well, you put your finger on a number of tender issues. There was one of your comments earlier, which I'd like to address first. A comment about the fact that New Orleans should not really have ever been allowed to grow as big as it did before, or as big as it was pre-Katrina, which is absolutely true.
Oh,
as most people know by now, 60% of the city is below sea level. And the Ninth Ward, the area that was most damaged by Hurricane Katrina, is in one of the lowest parts of the city. It's an area that, by all sort of natural rights, should be wetlands and would be wetlands if it had not been built upon. And if you go back historically, where the Ninth Ward is now used to be nothing but cypress forest.
Oh.
And cypress forest are cypress trees grow in
water. Yeah.
So the city, let's face it, it's a crazy place to build a city anyway. But to build a city, extend the city out into marshlands makes no sense at all.
Thank you.
All right. Any further, I guess I'm interested also in having you talk a little bit about this conflict and this tendency of finger pointing when you talk about who's responsible and who should pay the bills between the federal government, the state government of state of Louisiana, and perhaps also to some extent the municipal government for the city of New Orleans.
Well, Louisiana and Mississippi vie every year for being the poorest states in the Union, and I think it is no secret that Louisiana just doesn't have very much money. Now, isn't that ironical that most of our, or 25% of our oil and gas comes across that coast, but Louisiana is one of the poorest countries in the nation? And this is due to, in my opinion, a huge mistake in the way oil and gas royalties have been taxed. The federal government taxes any oil and gas production, and the tax, which is paid by the oil and gas companies, goes into the federal treasury. It doesn't go, Louisiana sees none of it, absolutely none of it, which is kind of a fiscal crime, I think. That money it could repair a lot of the damage and could construct miles of levees and the gates that we were just speaking of. Senators Landrieu and Vitter have introduced a bill to Congress, and one of the specs in that bill would be that Louisiana will get money from the oil and gas royalty tax. But this is, too late, really. Any big project, the richest state can't pay for some of these big projects, such as the Big Dig in Boston, which was the most expensive highway project in the nation, and that was largely paid for by the federal government. You know, the federal government really is the only entity in a position to put in the kind of protection that is needed for Louisiana or for any coastal area. And it's going to be a very interesting argument in the coming years as global warming picks up and as sea level rise picks up. There are a lot of cities along the coast of America that are becoming more and more vulnerable, and they need to be protected. And the federal government is not right now making any move to protect these cities, and it's going to be very interesting to see if it is willing to put any protection money into its budgets.
Well, goes back to, I think, about the comment you made about, in response to the caller's comment about New Orleans and whether it makes sense for there to be a city there at all or as big as it is. I think one of the things that we have seen in recent decades is that the coastal areas of this country, there's been a great development boom. It's understandable that people like the idea of living along there, but there are also areas that are environmentally sensitive and are very vulnerable to storm damage. And one might ask a question, maybe there are some of these places where people are living now that they shouldn't be living, and part of the solution to the problem is not protecting those places where people live, but encouraging them to move.
Well, that's very much part of the conversation now among coastal geologists and people who are going to study the fate of our coasts. And I think a lot of attention is being paid to sort of a leisure home development along the Gulf Coast, particularly Florida, which is almost wall-to-wall housing development subdivisions now, and very, very vulnerable. And they've seen there a number of hurricanes last summer and a lot of wreckage. And my reading of what's happening is that the developers are just coming right back and rebuilding. A lot of this is due to the policies of FEMA, who have an insurance policy in place for such people. And they're not discouraging people by any means, because if your house is wrecked, then FEMA will pay the insurance. Perhaps that policy should be changed, and perhaps it just there has to be a realization in the coming years that these coastal communities are not safe places to live, and they're costing the rest of the country billions and billions of dollars to protect.
We are moving into our last 15 minutes here. Let me quickly introduce again our guest. We'll get to another call. Christopher Halliwell is professor of English and journalism at Baruch College at City University of New York, has a special interest in cultural science and environmental journalism. He's the author of several books, two of them about life along the Louisiana coast. People of the Bayou is one, and the other is Holding Back the Sea, the struggle on the Gulf Coast to save America. It's recently been republished with a new introduction as a paperback. It's published by Harper Perennial. If you want to read it. We have another caller here to bring in. Oakwood is the caller here, line number one.
My question was much along what you've just been talking about. When they had a lot of floods on the Mississippi a few years back, they bought out a lot of the people and moved them to higher ground. And I wondered if it wouldn't be, if they're going to spend $200 billion on trying to restore New Orleans, if it wouldn't be better with that they spend that money to maybe save some of the old parts in New Orleans, but the major amount of it, move it or do something so that it isn't as vulnerable as it is in the future. And along with getting rid of the federal insurance protection, that the future could be safer from things of like catastrophic hurricanes. What's your
Well, you're right in concerning the floods in 1993 in the upper Mississippi River. And it was easy to move residents who were living in the floodplains onto the bluffs. High ground, no danger there, and buy them out. In New Orleans presents a bit of a problem, though, because there is no high ground. And so the future of New Orleans really depends upon a labor force. And the big problem now is that the labor force has no place to live. And, this is the largest port in the country, and the Midwest really is dependent upon the port of New Orleans. And it's 70% of it is closed now. Not that it was wrecked by any means by the hurricanes, but because there's no manpower there, and a lot of the infrastructure of New Orleans can't really get going because of the labor situation, and despite the fact that there is a lot of a migrant labor now in the city on a permanent basis, there really is no labor pool, and where in that low-lying area can you put them? The government has plans to create and is putting people in trailer parks, but that's really one would hope to be a very temporary solution, and they're not exactly close to New Orleans. It's very hard to get from these trailer parks that are in the north of Louisiana to New Orleans to get to work every morning. So this is a huge problem, and no one seems to be talking about it. People are saying that New Orleans is not coming back, and it's been many months since Katrina hit. New Orleans is just not coming back. There's kind of a little bit of panic going on because people can't just wait. And I've seen a couple of newspaper articles about restaurant owners and such who have just, they went back after Katrina, they opened up, and no one came to eat their food, and now they're closing up and moving on.
Is it possible for them to move, inland or further north up the Mississippi, or is the land still so low there that they couldn't move the port?
Oh, they, well, it's certainly possible for people to live inland on higher land. The port, you know, what you are asking is possible. The port probably could be moved up to Baton Rouge, 60 miles up the river, but it's a hard thing to do, considering the fact that you've got this pretty good infrastructure, port infrastructure, already in place in New Orleans. So it means kind of ripping that all apart and moving it upstream. Plus the fact that the French Quarter, the Uptown area, the Garden District area, these are the areas that are built on the higher land right next to the Mississippi. They are all intact. There's really relatively no damage there compared to the rest of the city. So you've got a lot of the city that is okay, and you've got the port that's okay. You just have the areas where the labor pool lives underwater still or under muck and uninhabitable. And it's hard to know what the solution is. It could be that some of these people could be housed on the western bank of the Mississippi River, where the land is a bit higher, and there could be an express transportation system to get them into the port area to work every morning. That would be cheaper than to move the whole port 60 miles upstream.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Other questions, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Just back at the beginning, we were talking about the fact that since the founding of New Orleans, that's 1718, in those years, there's been a loss of 2 million acres of wetlands along the Louisiana coast. There, at the time the city was founded, there were 5 million. Now today there are 3. And you said that most of that loss could be attributed to human activity. So let me ask you the question, are there some things that can be done or what could possibly be done to slow the rate of loss, maybe even stop it, and then perhaps create conditions for the wetlands to restore themselves?
Well, actually, people talk about the rate of loss as being 25 square miles per year. And actually that rate has decreased a bit over the past 10 years or so. And the reason for that is because there have been measures taken to slow down the deterioration. Some of the canals that both the Army Corps of Engineers and the oil and gas industry dredged have been plugged up, and so seawater can't surge into them. Boat traffic on some of the canals has been prohibited, and the wake from big tugs and barges has been responsible for washing away the banks of the canals and bayous to some extent. Sediment has been pumped up from the Mississippi River and piped into areas of the marsh that have deteriorated. All these small measures have helped to slow down the loss. And also, I should add, the barrier islands, which kind of ring the marsh on the Gulf side, have been bolstered up by building sand dunes on them and some use of rock jetties and things like that, which have stopped the winter storm surges from barreling into the marsh and chewing it up. So there has to be more of this kind of thing, definitely, but it has to be stepped up. The state of Louisiana received annually about $70 million from the federal government in order to execute these small things. They put together the state and all the municipalities and the state government put together a document called Coast 2050, which was a very, very forward-looking design concerning how the coast should look about in the year 2050. And it discussed all these plans, all these measures to restore and to save what remains. And the price tag, this was taken to the Army Corps of Engineers, and the Army Corps of Engineers looked at it and decided that it would cost about $14 billion to do this. And then it was introduced to Congress, and Congress turned thumbs down and said, no way. But if that $14 billion had been put in place, that's the kind of measure needed to save what remains. As it is now, the federal the bill that I mentioned earlier, introduced by Senators Landrieu and Vitter, call for $40 billion to do this exactly the same kind of work. So they could have, if $14 billion could have done it, now, because of all the damage of Katrina, the bill is up to $40 billion. And there's something blackly humor funny about that. But there are ways to save the coast, and one of the ones being pushed now, and a cheap, fast way, is to pump sediment from the Mississippi River into the marsh. And all the sediment now from the heartland flows down the Mississippi River and out into the Gulf of Mexico. This is sediment that used to flood into the marsh and replenish it every spring. Now it's just wasted. So there's talk about taking all of this sediment that's wasted offshore and using a piping technique, pump it back onto the marsh. This is, makes really good sense. The Army Corps of Engineers, however, has not been very favorably disposed towards this plan because it is not all that expensive. It does not involve huge, huge design. It does not involve a lot of concrete and rock. And the Corps loves concrete and rock and would prefer another plan, which is to create kind of redirect the Mississippi River. And create a third delta, and it's called the third delta conveyance, which would be an enormously expensive plan, and it would take about 50 years for it to do its job as designed. So there, despite all the damage, there is still huge conflict going on and a lot of arguments. But I certainly hope that the sediment slurry idea, piping all this wasted sediment nutrients from the Mississippi River into the marsh, is the one that prevails.
Mm-hmm. We're almost at the point where we have to finish. We have been talking about a bit about environmental impact and trying to raise questions about the significance of this coastal area to all of the country. I'm thinking about back to this other book I've mentioned a couple of times that you wrote, People of the Bayou, which you were looking at those people who actually lived off the marsh and how it is they live their lives. Here's another kind of loss one might talk about. Indeed, if this marsh area, if this wetland is being lost, what does that mean for a loss of a culture that is very unique?
Well, it means a loss of a culture,
a culture that's very
unique. And that's happening. It's happening in degrees. For example, a lot of these people used to be fur trappers in the wintertime, and the fur industry went bust as a result of a lot of pressure against wearing fur coats. And the irony is that a lot of the fur that was trapped, or the animals that were trapped, were nutria, and which is a kind of it's a rodent. It's about the size of a woodchuck, and has a long, skinny tail, and creates has very good fur, which used to be made into fur coats. And it used to be a very good industry for these people to go out into the marsh and trap these animals. Now they don't, and the nutria population has been exploding over the last 10 years, and actually the nutria, a very voracious animal, has eaten away at the marsh and destroyed hundreds of thousands of acres of marsh because they first eat the grass, then they dig up the roots and eat the roots. So this is sort of an irony. But there still are a lot of oystermen there, a lot of shrimpers, people who go out into the some of the big swamps and fish for crawfish during the spring. You still have remnants of the old life, but you also certainly you see families breaking up. These families used to be very cohesive, and they would all, all the fathers and sons would go into the marsh every winter. And you see families sort of breaking up their occupations, and a lot of young people go in, as young people do anyway, go into the cities, want to get away from that traditional quiet life. But if they had a livelihood, they would probably stay.
Yeah. Well, there we're going to have to stop. Our guest, Christopher Hallowell, is professor of English and journalism at Baruch College, City University of New York. His book, if you'd like to read it, is Holding Back the Sea, The Struggle on the Gulf Coast to Save America, published by Harper Perennial. Thanks very much.
Thank you.